quantum gravity lecture. My name is Renata Loll. I just flew in a couple of days ago. I hope to be learning all of your names by the time, certainly by the time I'm about to leave. This is my second time here. It's always a great pleasure to talk about quantum gravity because, well, it's what I work on and it's a truly interesting and exciting subject, but then I'm biased, obviously. It's also a bit of a challenge because, well, one could call it, this is a speculative theory, so this is not really, you know, settled physics, so some people even doubt whether such a theory exists. But let me see what we can say about it anyway. So really, what does one try to do in quantum gravity? One really tries to understand the quantum nature of space, time, and gravitation, which is, well, as we know from the classical theory, is basically one and the same thing. And what makes it so interesting is, of course, that one is really working at the boundary of what may be knowable in terms of physical theory. So that is a theory that's supposed to be applicable on very, very, very high energy scales. So energy scales we cannot currently, you know, reach with observation, let alone experiment. So, but if we could, it might in principle open up how we understand extreme conditions, like what prevailed at the very beginning of the universe when we had extreme, you know, high densities. And can we ask a thing like, what is the structure, the microscopic, the truly microscopic structure of space and time? Can we understand that in the same way as we understand the quantum microscopic structure of other theories of fundamental interactions? Can we, in principle, so for the science fiction aficionados among you, is there something like wormholes? That's an aspect of space and time. And as far as we understand, in order to find the answer to that question, you really have to know about the quantum properties of space and time. Okay, so let me start by writing what we really want to understand. This is a fundamental theory. Quantum gravity, and in what follows, I will almost always abbreviate that as QG. And what is this supposed to mean? In first approximation, I wanted to quantitatively describe of space-time and its structure, so that, of course, also encodes gravitational interactions. On all scales. Of course, what we are particularly interested in are the very short scales, because that's where kind of the quantum aspects should come into play. But of course, on large scales, this should, where suitable, should coincide with the classical theory of gravity, Einstein's general relativity. And what would also be nice is if it were to make some new predictions, which we could go out and test and verify the theory. We are not quite there yet, so that's why I'm inserting this hopefully. Of course, only if we achieve that, you know, we can be kind of, we can join it to the canon of established physics. Now, so one way to think about quantum gravity is really an analogy with the other fundamental interactions, the nuclear and the electromagnetic. And from that point of view, you could ask, well, if I go to shorter and shorter and shorter scales, is there this search for microstructure of space and time? Is it kind of an atomic nature, by which I mean, are there some smallest constituents? I mean, what determines the behavior of this theory on very, very short length scales? What is the nature of the quantum excitations? How do they interact? And how do they interact in such a way that when I look at the theory on very large scales, kind of what re-emerges is really classical aspects, classical known aspects of space and time. Is there some microstructure, quantum microstructure of this kind? So can I make, in particular, can I make this quantitative? So in a way, one way to think about it is this is kind of the ultimate form of reductionism. So that has been an extremely, of course, successful recipe with regard to the rest of physics, trying to understand things in terms of smaller constituents and their kind of more fundamental laws of interaction. Now, is this all also conceivable? Is it conceivable that we can do it for gravity too? So that's really kind of one of the question marks. So on alternative, well, I'll just put, if I write down one more line, can people see this, or is this too low already? Still visible? Okay, so another way, therefore, to say what quantum gravity is about is to try and figure out what the fundamental degrees of freedom are at the Planck scale, or maybe even below the Planck scale, so at sub-Planckian scales, degrees of freedom, and what the dynamics is of course, in principle, we don't really know a priori, you know, what these degrees of freedom are. We can try and get an idea, obviously, from looking at what the classical degrees of freedom are, you know, geometry, curvature. But we don't really know what will be left of these classical, of this classical description once we go to these very, very short scales. Now, really, as I kind of hinted at the beginning, this course really should come with a kind of with a health warning. So unless, you know, what you learn in quantum mechanics, bits and pieces of quantum field theory, statistical mechanics, I mean, this is not yet a part of established a theory. So if one were unkind, one could say, well, this is all highly speculative. If one were less unkind, one can call it far beyond standard model physics, right? So this is definitely part of that, and one should keep reminding oneself that, you know, really we still have some time to go, and there are various provisos that come with talking about quantum gravity. So currently, and that's part of the problem a little bit, there are no experiments to guide us, no observations which we have figured out could, you know, tell us which way to go in quantum gravity, because the scales at which these quantum effects become relevant are just so ridiculously small. So we have, as yet, no experiments or observations to guide us with regard to our theory building. Of course, we have the classical theory, and we can take some inspiration from that. But this is, of course, a bit of an unfortunate and also unusual situation, because very successful theories, think of, you know, quantum theory, early quantum theory, as the 1920s. Of course, the theory went kind of hand in hand with experiments trying to understand atomic spectra, for example. And that's, of course, extremely useful, because the danger, if you don't have observations and experiments guiding you, is simply to go out on a tangent. I mean, to let your maybe imagination roam a little bit too wildly, or just to extrapolate where it's not warranted. Of course, what we do really, it's not that we know nothing about physics. Of course, there's an enormous amount we've learned in 20th century about, you know, quantum theories, things being quantum theories, or you know, what general relativity has taught us, and what kind of general principles underlie physics. And what we do, therefore, is kind of to try and extrapolate kind of from the maximum we know from the other interaction and try to import this to try and find a theory of quantum gravity. So, of course, that's not nothing. You know, that's very real physics. But, of course, one has to be careful. One's extrapolations can simply go wrong or be misguided. Now, what one question that raises is also, in such a situation where you don't have experiments, maybe what is the most opportune way, or the least, how shall I say, the most practical way to try and construct a theory? And of course, there one can also take various attitudes, and we'll get back to this later in the lectures. Now, what my aim here will be is to try and give you some guidance to the field. So, of course, a lot of this is also based on classical theory, on trying to understand how certain geometric aspects of classical gravity may translate into quantum language. I'll also try and give you an idea of, you know, what have people done in quantum gravity, how far have they got with what kind of methods, and where do we stand, and what does make this so difficult in a way? Why haven't we got further than we have? One warning is that, well, in the 15 hours of lecture or so I have available, it will be completely impossible for me to really give you a comprehensive guide of the field, because that encompasses research of 50, 60 years or so. But, you know, I'll try to give you the broader outlines, and of course, with some of the instances, be more specific, so you understand, kind of at least you get a glimpse of what the theory is about. Well, why do we believe that a theory of quantum gravity should really exist? That really has to do with extrapolating kind of from 20th century physics, and primarily, I would phrase it this way. I mean, two fundamental aspects we have learned about the physics are that both kind of quantum theory and in a different manner, which I'll explain, and gravity are universal. Now, what do I mean by quantum theory being universal? That is just the statement that, as far as we can tell, every self-respecting theory of fundamental interaction is at its core a quantum theory, not a classical theory. Although, say, when you go to sufficiently long distance scales, think of, you know, Maxwell electrodynamics, classical equations are perfectly adequate in describing the situation. However, if one would just confine oneself to the classical description, one theory would be very incomplete. Namely, when I then come to, you know, describing microscopic phenomena, atomic structure, etc., I know I have to use quantum laws to do that. And of course, the same is also intrinsically true for the short-range nuclear interactions. Now, so as far as we can tell, well, physical theories just are quantum theories. So that makes us think that probably gravity, you know, at its most fundamental level, is also a quantum theory. There are occasionally, well, since the quantum effects however, are so weak, there is nothing at this point, you know, we can just kind of put our finger on and say, look, gravity has to be quantized because otherwise this experimental number, you know, would be 4, and I can see it's 3. So there's nothing like that we can, you know, we can point to currently. That again goes back to the absence of experiments or observations directly related to quantum gravity. So it's still a consistent and, I could say, even pragmatic point of view to say, well, why should I bother quantizing gravity? Anyway, I don't know what that would entail, you know, in terms of observables. I have no idea of how to verify or falsify these statements, so, you know, why bother? So it's certainly a pragmatic point of view. However, I would really insist that really, from what we know, you know, about the rest of physics, most people think that is exceedingly unlikely. Although, of course, practically, it doesn't make much of a difference at this stage. Now, what do I mean by universality of gravity? With this, I really mean a property of the classical theory of gravity. That is, anything that has either carries either matter or energy is subject to gravitational interactions. Of course, and gravity is, of course, also universe is attractive. What does that mean? Well, you cannot get away from gravity. So, you know, gravity, you exert gravity just by virtue of having, you know, mass and energy. And every other object in the known universe also has, of course, including something like, you know, light rays, which also carry energy. And they are, therefore, themselves subject to gravity, but also exert gravitational attractive forces on whatever is around them. So there's no way of getting away from gravity. And in this sense, gravity is universal. Everything is subject to gravity, so that as far as we can tell. So there are no gravity shields you can build, you know, to get away from the effects of gravity, as hard as you may try. And that is, of course, also what underlies, in general relativity, that I may ascribe the effects of gravity to space-time itself. So that's, of course, the kind of reinterpretation that comes with general relativity, about which I understand you'll be learning much more in the course of the next 3 weeks or so. But we had some in your courses already. So the essential thing there is that when we interpret gravitational forces as being associated with a non-trivial local structure of space and time, namely its curvature, and the way we feel that curvature is then through gravitational interaction. But the reason for why we're able to ascribe it to space-time is exactly this universality. If there were things that were exempt from gravity, then I couldn't rephrase them in the way that Einstein did. Okay, now, classical gravity. Let me phrase kind of the problem of quantum gravity in analogy with what I can say about classical gravity. So this is, of course, I always will mean general relativity, abbreviated GR in the following. So what one does there, of course, what is classical gravity about? It's solving a bunch of, you know, coupled partial differential equations for a field quantity. That's a gravitational field, or the space-time metric G mu nu. So that's the essence of what one tries to do there. Einstein's equations. So you start with these equations, and they're defined on a set of space-time metrics, and the metrics explain to you what curvature and metric structure a space-time or a piece of space-time has. That means I have to work and solve these equations before I know what allowed classical space-time is. You know, it's of course subject to the matter content, I mean stuff that is in the space-time or the universe, and subject to boundary conditions. Once I fix those, I then have to go and solve these equations, and then I know, aha, that is the solution. So that is space-time, a specific space-time that solves it for these, for a specific matter content and boundary conditions. So once I've done this, I end up with what I call this kind of possible space-times. So solutions, possible solutions to these equations that can be realized according to this theory. And sometimes I'll abbreviate that as an ST. So, in a way, what I do want to do in quantum gravity, or what I expect I have to do in order to solve quantum gravity, I have to give you kind of an analog, a quantum analog of a set of dynamical equations I want to solve. And solving them will tell me what I mean by a quantum space-time. So that means a space-time that gives me a valid description on all scales, including the very small. Okay. So then, of course, I have to tell you what these quantum equations are, and well, and how to solve them. So that's a way of thinking about quantum gravity. So I want to solve here now. Let me put this in inverted commas. I want to solve quantum Einstein equations. And those should give me solutions which are then kind of possible, physically realizable quantum spacetimes. So what these are, I a priori don't know. And also, you should not read that too literally as a bunch of equations. It just has to be some quantum dynamical principle. You'll see some examples of that later in the lecture. So that the famous Wheeler-DeWitt equation in quantum gravity, in canonical quantum gravity, is one example, but also kind of a path integral, perturbative or non-perturbative, is another way of expressing a quantum dynamical principle where one then has to solve specific equations here. Okay, of course, what is one aspect that makes the quantum theory more involved and kind of non-standard is the fact that usually when I deal with other quantum fields, I consider them on a given fixed background. So I'm fixing what space-time is, and therefore also, if you like, what quantum space-time is. I'm fixing that one and for all, and I'm not touching it anymore. And then I consider what kind of interactions take place on this fixed background. And there is never any dynamical feedback of, you know, the stuff, the other fields, that their dynamics onto the structure of this space-time, which is usually, of course, taken to be Minkowski space. So I never touch Minkowski space. You know, it's just there as a kind of a flat background structure. And the interesting things happen in Minkowski space, but they don't do anything to Minkowski space. Of course, gravity is different. Here, already in the classical theory, one is interested in how, well, a certain energy and matter content deforms space-time. So you see here there is a kind of a qualitative difference, what one considers kind of as fixed in the other quantum interactions suddenly becomes the dynamical variable of the theory, namely the four-dimensional metric. So that is just something to keep in mind. Space-time geometry in gravity already classically is dynamical. So not a fixed background. So one part of constructing quantum gravity is certainly specifying what these quantum Einstein equations are going to be. But of course, that's not the end of it. But of course, then one has to solve them. Of course, classically, we already know that this is absolutely not a non-trivial thing to do. I mean, we don't know what the most general solution to the Einstein equations is. We simply don't know. We know specific classes of simple solutions which one gets by making additional simplifying symmetry assumptions. Now, the tricky part about the Einstein series, of course, that it's nonlinear in the dynamical variable. And the sets of equations that describe this are pretty involved and complicated. What will happen in the quantum theory? Well, that remains to be seen. Now, one guideline we certainly have in constructing such a theory, it must be the case that, you know, you construct a theory of quantum gravity for me, and that if I now look at this theory on suitably large scales, suitably low energies, that it must kind of smoothly go over into the known theory that is applicable and very well tested on large scales, and that is, again, Einstein's theory of general relativity. So we have one concrete, if you like, condition that the quantum theory must satisfy. It must have, as we say, a good classical limit. So it must go over on suitably a large distance scales or low energy scales to the known classical theory. Of course, well, that still leaves, you know, lots of wiggle space in the quantum theory, but it's actually not so trivial to satisfy. So if one really comes up, if one, by whatever method, has constructed a theory one believes is a good quantitative description at the Planck scale, it's actually a non-trivial thing to make it consistent on large scales with classical structures. So that turns out actually to be a non-trivial condition. Okay, so let me just put this as one more remark. So what we need is that starting with some theory of quantum gravity that produces one or more objects I may want to call quantum spacetimes for me, what I know has to be satisfied is that in a suitable classical limit, this should produce general relativity, and which of course has classical spacetimes as its solutions. Now, one thing I find kind of helpful to consider, kind of starting with quantum gravity, is to look at kind of all physical scales and just see what role is played by gravity or quantum gravity, depending, you know, on the, say, the distance scale we look at. So let me just draw this here. This will be a logarithmic scale in powers of 10. Well, larger distances are on the right. So let me start here right to the right here, 10 to the 24 meters. That is roughly the size of the visible universe. So, you know, where we can just barely receive information from. And of course, what lies beyond? Well, we simply have no idea. We, as a matter of principle, well, we don't have access to, clearly. So that's where we are at as a maximal scale. Now, let's see. So we are somewhere a little bit out of the middle. We are about here. So distance scales of a meter. That's us. Okay. Now, here in between, of course, this is all, you know, our universe. Solar system, galaxies, clusters of galaxies, largest, you know, non-trivial structures we see in terms of matter distribution on large scales. And now going to smaller scales, of course, we get to kind of atomic scales. 10 to the minus 8 meters, perhaps. And what we can currently access experimentally with the most powerful particle accelerators. So these are our most powerful, you know, microscopes, if you like, or magnifying glasses to directly understand what goes on very short length scales. It's about 10 to the minus 90 meters. So that's the LHC, which has come online. What we observe, the most energetic particles we observe are ultra-high kind of cosmic rays. They are about 8 magnitudes. I mean, you can read this as length scales, but I can kind of identify distance scales in a natural way with energy scales. So diminishing distances are associated with higher and higher energies. And of course, the energies are those, for instance, you know, I have to accelerate these particles to have them smashed together to resolve certain smaller and smaller distance scales. So that's the way it works. So ultra-high ultra-high energy cosmic rays, they lie a few orders of magnitude of even higher energies. And now this brings me to kind of the Planck length. And this is, as I said before, the ridiculously small length scale of 10 to the minus 35 meters, where we believe that quantum effects of gravity should become important. And the way you get to that length scale is you consider the natural constants that should kind of be non-trivially involved in any computation to do with quantum gravitational effects. These are the Newton constant, telling you about the strength of gravity. It's the speed of light for kind of the relativistic aspect of this, and h-bar for the quantum. And if you take those three dimensionful constants of nature together and ask yourself, how small is the natural length scale I can build from those, there is just a single possibility of doing this. And that exactly produces the natural kind of length scale for quantum gravitational phenomena, this 10 to the minus 35 meters for quantum gravity. So this is what interests me primarily when I talk about quantum gravity. And you really see this is really, I mean, absurdly, it's another 16 orders of magnitude beyond what we can currently probe. So there are no particle accelerators that are in the pipeline that will, with similar methods or technology, be able to get to anywhere near this scale. And that's, of course, just a rephrasing of the problem I mentioned earlier, namely the absence of direct experimental verification. Yeah?
How do we know that the gravitational constant is constant? It doesn't change with energy scale?
You don't consider that for this argument. You just take it as it is. Therefore, all kinds of fancy things might happen which interfere with this naive argument I've just given to you. So I'm not claiming this is watertight, but you know, this is how one usually argues. Now, these are the length scales. Now, where is gravity in here? Right. Gravity is obviously is very, very important on very large length scales. Why? Well, I said gravity is very weak, so why does it become important? Well, it becomes important because the other long-range interactions, the electromagnetic interactions, could potentially also contribute on long-distance scales, but it just so happens that the objects we see and find in our universe are, to first approximation, neutral. I mean, electromagnetically neutral on large length scales. So, well, you don't see those interactions anymore. So that means all that's left over when I come to really long distance scales in the universe are the gravitational interaction. And although they're very, very weak, of course, well, their cumulative effect, all the stuff that does sit in the universe, means that they are essentially the factor that decides the dynamics of these large scale structures. So galaxies, clusters of galaxies. Yeah. These were the ultra-high energy cosmic rays. So that was just to give you an example of a phenomenon we do observe in nature, although it's not that we could access it experimentally, but we see very highly energetic particles that have energies a few orders of magnitude beyond those which we can produce on Earth, kind of this accelerator technology. Now, so here this is kind of all the realm of classical general relativity. So that basically, if you know, it's very verified, this classical theory, to a considerable degree. So it's a very good theory within its range of applicability. And so if you then talk about kind of desktop experiments, go to kind of centimeter, millimeter, then at least what you can kind of experimentally verify are things like the weak equivalence principle, so which are themselves ingredients in the theory of general relativity. But of course, you can then ask, now what happens here on these smaller scales? And it seems that gravity is completely irrelevant. And what's the essential reason? Well, it's so much weaker than the other forces. Now, of course, when you come, say, to atomic scales, of course, things are no longer electromagnetically neutral, on the contrary. So that is really the realm of where electromagnetism on larger scales, you know, molecular, atomic, but then of course also the nuclear forces come in and play the dominant role. And they are just so, so much larger than gravity that, you know, something I'll ask you to do in the exercise, if you consider, say, a couple of protons that don't move too fast, and you consider how they repel themselves, say, electromagnetically, just, you know, electrostatics, and how they attract each other by virtue of the fact that they both have a mass, then you'll find just, you can compute the difference in magnitude yourself, and you see it's many, many, many orders of magnitude that gravity is weaker. Many, many. So you do that calculation yourself, and then you understand, well, seemingly in first approximation, well, gravity doesn't seem to come in at all. On these scales, and you don't really have to, if you compute Feynman amplitudes, you know, of these scattering experiments, you don't really have to compute the gravitational corrections, you know, the graviton corrections to those, because they are totally negligible. Okay, so here was the Planck length. I just wanted, again, that will be part of an exercise. So that's what it is. This is this naive definition. So this is a Planck, the Planck length, and you get it from multiplying Newton's constant with h bar, dividing by c cubed, and taking the square root of this. Now, of course, here we have the other interaction, say, you know, the nuclear interactions, which of course contribute in a very crucial way to dynamics at, you know, on these scales. Now, the point is that because gravity is so much weaker, so what does that mean? Well, it really means that g Newton is a very small number, right? Because that's what goes into even, you know, the Newton's law of attraction of two masses. I multiplied with Gn, and that tells me, I mean, in absolute terms, what the relative force is. So G Newton is very small. That means that the scale at which I expect the quantum effects to be relevant is also so much smaller than for the other interactions. So that explains why, you know, the Planck length, where all these things should come together, is just so much smaller than, say, the LHC 10 to the minus 19. Meters here. So that's the weakness of gravity you see again kind of illustrated here. Now, yeah, as I said, I mean, quantum gravity, you know, should take place somewhere around this scale. But it's not currently sufficiently developed to make any firm prediction. So the models that are around really do not yet make any predictions. Of course, what you really want to, what you really are looking for is that since you cannot observe stuff at the Planck length directly, what you're really hoping when you're talking about quantum gravity is that there is some kind of effect, I mean, some kind of magnifying, you know, effect, or you can think of some observations that would be sensitive to what happens here in such a way that I can make some kind of observation on a larger scale where I do have access to it that would probe aspects of stuff that happens at the Planck scale. So this is clearly something one is hoping for. If everything were just confined here, you know, forever to this unobservable length, even, and I could not find any effect, say cumulative effect, that would lead to some measurable difference on larger scales, I think then one could really just as well say, oh, well, forget about the whole story. But so what I'm referring to is what some people have started calling quantum gravity phenomenology. So that is really to try and pinpoint effects or observations I could make in nature that might be sensitive to quantum gravitational structures on a much shorter scale. And that has started over the last few years. And people are, it's a good direction to think into, I would say. Currently, it's really hampered by the fact that we don't have sufficiently complete models of quantum gravity. So, you know, they might predict this thing, they might predict this other thing, but really, they are not tight enough, our own models and theories, to be able to come up, even if one has, you know, looks at some specific effect that would be, for example, what people have considered is perturbations on observed dispersion relations. So one thing one might imagine, just to give you an example of what this quantum gravity phenomenology might be about, is you take a light ray that has traveled to us kind of from the edge of the visible universe. So it has traveled an enormously long time. Now imagine you had a specific way in which to predict that some specific microstructure of space-time would have, I mean, an effect that it would exert on the propagation of these light rays. And in addition, that it would be an effect such that it kind of accumulates, you know, along the path of this photon and then lead to some measurable effect like, you know, a frequency-dependent time delay, for example, when it arrives here on Earth. So that is an example of an effect that people, you know, have considered might be there. Again, I don't think one can really, with good conscience, say anything very specific of that about this before one doesn't have a better idea of what such a quantum theory is about. Okay, so that was kind of part of an overview. Introduction, illustrating already some aspects we expect to play a role now when we start talking about quantum gravity proper. What I really cannot emphasize enough is really that to understand that theory, you need a thorough grounding in understanding what the classical theory of gravity and of classical space-time is about, because these are the degrees of freedom one wants to quantize after all. So what is the nature of this theory? You must have played around with this a little bit. And you'll also see in various issues I'll address in the course, we're going back to first consider a specific aspect of the classical theory and then ask ourselves, how might that be reflected in the quantum theory? So a solid knowledge of these classical structures or, you know, acquainting yourself with those is really necessary and important to understand quantum gravity. Okay. Of course, what I don't have at this stage is a good feeling, you know, what everyone's background is, you know, say, for how much do you already know about general relativity. So, you know, alert me if I'm totally going completely over your heads. Of course, this course will be proceeding in parallel with Gregory's course. So, and I think it is manageable. So the stuff I'll be telling you will be kind of complementary, but of course will be strongly enhanced by what she's going to tell you about as a classical structures. But again, please alert me to any problems. And let me just begin, just say a little bit about the classical theory, you know, just for the to set the stage a little bit, is of course what I said before. I mean, the fact that gravity, that is really the one-liner summarizing the essence, is that gravity is space-time geometry, or space-time geometry is what's described by gravity. Is, with capital letters, space-time geometry. And just to fix my notation a little bit, whenever I talk about the metric or the metric field, that's of course a tensorial quantity, which is kind of the crucial dynamical object whose dynamics you want to understand in the classical theory. Call this G mu nu, that's standard notation. And of course, it is a local, it's a field quantity, that means it depends on x. And the metric can just change depending on where you are in space and time. And my convention for the signature, of course, this is a four metric with Lorentzian signature. I will use the general relativist's convention, where the space components enter with a plus in the metric. So my Minkowski metric is a diagonal minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. Of course, it's unimportant, but it can confuse you if you mix different conventions. Now, this metric, I just put some things in a nutshell just to fix a notation, gives rise, or the way we usually specify what the metric of a given space is, or space-time, we write down its infinitesimal line element as ds squared equals to g mu nu of x dx mu, dx nu, where x mu are local coordinates on your space-time. What we'll assume in the following, and these are also standard assumptions you make in GR usually, that you're talking about a space-time that is a four-dimensional differentiable manifold, let me call it M4, and you usually assume that has a product topology where time is just a real line, and then you're talking about moments, instances of time, which are given by spatial submanifolds, which are three-dimensional, and they're spatial. That means that the induced three-dimensional metric is positive definite on the spatial directions. Now, this is not what I'm teaching here, so this is classical GR. Now, from this space-time metric G mu nu, you construct various interesting quantities that have to do with the curvature properties of your space, which you obtain by taking suitable first and second derivatives of this metric tensor, 4 by 4 tensor. And among them are the Levi-Civita connection, connection which contains first derivatives of the metric, and that's usually called capital gamma, mu nu lambda. It's not a true tensor, but let me not dwell on this right now. Then there are the various curvature tensors. So there's the Riemann tensor, which is an object with four indices, kappa, lambda, mu, nu, that contains first and second derivatives of the metric G mu nu. And then there are contractions of this, like the Ricci tensor, R mu nu of x, and the Ricci scalar, where you also, so this comes about by contracting the middle lower index with the upper one, so setting them equal and using some convention, and raising with the metric G mu nu this mu here, and setting those two indices equal gives rise to the Ricci scalar R. So what I'm assuming is that you know what these things are about, and if you don't know quite now, you'll at least know within the next few days. Now, one important aspect that the classical theory has to do with the symmetry properties of this description. Now, in order, as already suggested by the notation I'm choosing here, one, in principle, I mean, curvature properties of a space-time are things that exist independent of the choice of a coordinate system. So, and you can do experiments to try and understand, say, what the curvature is of our real, of our own, of a piece of space-time or our universe by making experiments, say, by looking how light rays are bent, say, if they pass by a massive object that might be our sun, as well as a classical GR experiment, or it might be some other heavy, a cluster of galaxies that sits somewhere in between, a very distant light source we might observe from Earth and us, and that might produce things like lensing effects. And all of these things, I mean, you can go out and measure, and they are really independently there. They have nothing to do with a specific choice of coordinates. But what we do usually do in the classical theory in order to be able to write down these tensors is we must make a choice of coordinate system. And that makes things nice and manageable and calculable. But on the other hand, kind of on the minus side, it introduces a redundancy in the theory, because it turns out it's the physical content of the theory is totally independent of any specific choice of coordinates I make, just in order to label my points in a one-to-one manner and be able to write down these curvature quantities. So that is completely independent of it. So what I mean, rephrasing this, is to say, by introducing coordinates, as I really have to do in the continuum, because that's the only way I can manipulate these quantities in an easy way, it introduces an overcompleteness, a redundancy in the theory. And that actually brings with it some complications also in the quantum theory. So it's an example of what one calls a gauge invariance. So there is a number of operations one can perform, namely coordinate changes that do not affect the physics and the outcome of the computation of kind of observable quantities in the theory. These are transformations that apply on the space of field. So in this case, on these G mu nu's. Yeah? Because if I say I have a given curved space-time that is characterized by a G mu nu of x, so that it means, of course, a specific set of functions. Yeah, U and U run from 0 to 0 to 3. So this is a symmetric array of, well, 16 numbers, so 10 of them are independent. So it is just for a given curved classical space, and this is just a fixed array of 10 numbers per space-time point. Now, if I perform a coordinate transformation, so on the axis, yeah, to some new coordinates y, some one-to-one coordinate transformation, then, of course, this g mu nu will look totally different, kind of as functions of these new coordinates, but still describe the same physics. So that means, and this is an example of kind of a redundancy in the formulation. Well, it's already classically, it can be tricky to understand, you know, that what I'm giving you is a space-time you already know, but I've written it down in unfamiliar coordinates, so you cannot tell that it's perhaps even Minkowski space. I mean, something simple as that, because I've, you know, decided to give you very screwy coordinates, you know, to fool you and make you think it's something really complicated. But in reality, you know, it's a flat space without any curvature. This can be achieved by a simple coordinate transformation. And in the quantum theory, one has to deal with this overcompleteness, with this redundancy. Because, for example, if you take a kind of a quantum superposition of all possibilities, and that's something one just does when one constructs a quantum theory, then one only wants to count physically distinguishable configurations once. So you don't want to count, you know, a given space-time with one set of coordinates, and you count it again, you know, where I describe this space-time in a different set of coordinates. So we don't want to do that. We just want to count it once. So one has to then think about how, even in very concrete computational terms, how to get rid of this redundancy. And that makes actually part of the difficulty in constructing physical quantities, so even in something like perturbative quantum gravity. So now, with this issue of the coordinates goes one picture that is useful in thinking about, you know, what it means, what it all means physically. So one works in these local coordinate charts. That just means I have a local coordinate system x mu. So here is my manifold m. This is just my four-dimensional space-time. Now, I consider a little open patch in it, which I call u, and a point p. So here, there is no talk of coordinates at all. So that is just, whatever, a piece of curved space-time or a whole space-time. Now, a coordinate you can think of as a function of this space. So that is an abstract curved space whose properties you're interested in. Now, what you do in order to get a computational handle on these is to define coordinate functions on this space that locally map you, or say map this neighborhood of the point P into an open subset of R4 in this case, if you're talking about a four-dimensional space-time, right? So this is, say, let this be mapped to some, say, the origin of some other point here. So this is would be X mu of the point P, and of course, this being a chunk of an open subset of R4 means that I can just uniquely specify, I mean, each of these points now has a label, a unique point here from, say, a neighborhood of this point or a neighborhood of the origin. And this is, of course, only one possibility of doing it, and that is a coordinate choice. Yeah? So I want to encourage you by drawing it like this to say, aha, well, this is kind of what I really want to describe. And then I have many, many possibilities of introducing maps, which I should think of as functions on this space, which are coordinates. And, well, thinking about this way, it makes it, the arbitrariness of the choice just relates it to, you know, choosing different coordinate functions like that. So you think now of the coordinate as a function on that kind of abstract space whose properties you're interested in. But what we usually do is we go to a coordinate frame that usually will only be good locally. We do our computations. Say, you know, we compute these curvature tensors. We then construct some things that are invariant under the choice of gauge and, well, or the choice of coordinates, I should say. And we extract the physics in this way. So in all we do, we usually, you know, we go here, do our computation, and then get information, find the information in such a way that it is no longer dependent on the coordinates. And that will then characterize the true physics. Okay, so this is just a little glimpse of the classical theory. To fix, as I said, you know, some aspects and some notation, I won't dwell on this anymore. What I'll do in the rest of the lectures is this week I'll essentially be, apart from these introductory remarks, we will be talking about perturbative quantum gravity and how it relates to how it is to be thought of as quantizing linearized gravity, which has kind of wave-like excitations, so the way the gravitational fields are weak. In the second week, we'll basically be talking about canonical quantization and non-perturbative quantization, so then one doesn't make the assumption necessarily that the fields are weak. And in the third week, we'll turn to covariant path integral quantization in a non-perturbative context. So that will hopefully, you know, give you an overview of the subject. There is no single reference which really is perfect for that covers all that I do, but the best I can do is to recommend this book that is the best for our course in terms of being comprehensive. That is has appeared in Oxford University Press. It's called Quantum Gravity, and the author is Kiefer, Klaus Kiefer. And I hear, so this is actually a very popular book. I hear this is the second edition that appeared 3 years ago, 4 years ago. I heard that a third edition is on its way. I don't know whether it's out yet. So this is, of course, it's a thick book, huh? And we are not going to cover, you know, in any approximation what's in here. But it's nice in the sense that it covers a lot of ground, not everything in depth. But anyway, this is a course for beginner. So that is a book I can recommend parallel with the course. Some other recommendation of some other literature I'll put on one of the problem sheets this afternoon. And if you have further questions, and as we go along in the course, I'll also point out if I think there's something that might be useful for you to read. Okay, I'll thank you, and I'll see you again tomorrow, same time, same place.